Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic. It is my pleasure to welcome Paul Doust to the podcast. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, James. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Paul, for those that may not be familiar with you, you're the managing director and founder of CO Asset Management. You're also heavily involved with PMAC as well. You've been involved in asset management, reliability, maintenance for 25 plus years. Working in all different aspects, risk management, integrity, operational excellence, lean practices, safety, and actual asset management practices. What did I miss in that brief introduction that you want to make sure we cover?
Oh, wow. I think you've covered it all. I would also maybe add to that some of my engineering roles, commissioning, reliability, project engineering, that kind of stuff too.
All right. Very good. And I said 25 years. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's a little bit over that. It's about almost 28 years now that I've been in industry, mostly power generation, some oil and gas, but I've tried to learn practices in other industries as well and see what we can take and use that's practical and value added.
Excellent. And now I always want to ask, what got you started in this type of career? You know, maintenance, reliability, asset management.
Oh, interesting. Well, I'm a second generation power generation guy. My dad was a welder at a coal-fired power plant in Saskatchewan. And I worked for SAS Power for a few summers. And then it was kind of natural for me to, when I graduated from university, to get a job there. And my first job was fascinating because it was commissioning a new power plant. So I was very green and I learned a lot and haven't stopped learning since.
Oh, absolutely not. My first foray into maintenance was in a greenfield startup as well, and commissioning lines, installing lines, the whole nine yards. And you want to learn a lot quickly, being a greenfield startup and be there from the beginning. Definitely learn a lot.
Absolutely. Fast. Couldn't agree more. And the project I was on was a very well-run project, and there was lots of senior guys that I was able to learn from. They took me under their wing. So that was very, very helpful. After that project, there wasn't a heck of a lot from an engineering perspective. So I turned my attention to maintenance. I've also been involved in some large projects that haven't gone so well, and there's lots of learnings from that as well.
Absolutely. What not to do.
Exactly.
Excellent. Now, you recently started CO Asset Management. Now, what is CO and what does that mean?
So CO, the word comes from a Latin word, means I know or I understand. And what it is, it's an online knowledge as a service for operational leaders and practitioners of asset management and operational excellence. And what we do is provide a forum for competency development for those people. So it's a variety of different things. I've got a presence on Patreon, a platform where we'll be sharing in the community our body of knowledge that we're developing. And we'll have one-on-one personalized coaching as well. I think leaders today have tremendous challenge. And I think there's certain competencies in asset management. So when I say asset management, I'm thinking about ISO 55000. And more specifically, if for example, in the Global Forum for Maintenance Asset Management, their asset management landscape document, there's 39 subjects. I find that leaders are good in some of them, but could use some polishing up in some others. And so that's what that's kind of the space that we aim to fill is broad width of knowledge and depth as much as needed.
Excellent. Well, you need to sign me up then for configuration management and systems engineering. Definitely two I am not strong in and need to get better at.
Right.
Now, I know one of those key elements in there is they're all around risk management. And that is vitally important in any sort of asset management. So how important really, though, is that risk management component to an asset management program or system?
I think it's very important. You know, it's particularly important, you know, once the assets are built and you're in that operation and maintenance phase of the asset lifecycle. Depending on the industry, it's a little bit different for different sectors. But, you know, a lot of the activities that we do within the organization are different forms of risk management. And, you know, every company does risk management, but very often, in my opinion, these organizations could serve to improve their risk management practices in order to obviously reduce their risk, but improve their bottom line as well.
Very good. Now, you mentioned their risk management practices. So what exactly is risk management and how does that actually work in reality?
So for me, a practical risk management framework has a few different elements to it. So, you know, there's the identification of risk, the evaluation, there's the decisions around risk, and the mitigative actions that arise directly from, you know, the operation and maintenance of assets. And of course, what you're trying to do is avoid the consequences that could adversely affect your business and your business plans, right? So to be successful, you need to adequately manage your risk. So again, I'm focusing on more of the operational risks, which are primarily the risks of equipment failing to meet their service levels or failing catastrophically. There's other risks as well that are maybe not operational, like financial risks, market risk, regulatory risks, and again, those are sometimes specific by industry sector. And I say risk, but I also mean opportunities as well, because risks are kind of the negative side, but any opportunities to improve should be part of the risk management framework as well. And a big part for me is all about the decision making. Sure, part of it's process, but for me, good asset management, and specifically in this case, good risk management, is all about making more better decisions than you would have otherwise.
Yeah, it's about identifying what are those risks and opportunities, because if I remember the correct definition from ISO 31000, is that it is risks negatively and those positive opportunities as well. It considers both. It's not just looking at the negatives. And what I see currently in a lot of organizations is they just focus on that negative piece. But what if all of a sudden market demand peaks and now we don't have enough production capacity to meet that need? That is an opportunity, but it's also a risk as well. And we need to consider those sorts of things.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's managed the same way. And if you make hay while the sun is shining, as you say, when times are good, you can actually set yourself up in a better position for maybe when times are bad. So yeah, you're absolutely right.
Now, why do organizations need this sort of framework to drive decision-making? Can't they just make these decisions without the process and all this follow through and so on and so forth?
I think they can. And, you know, historically, if you go back decades, there wasn't a lot of formality. And yeah, risks were made as you bumped into each problem. And, what I've learned is different people have different ways of making decisions. They have different risk tolerances. So specifically for the decision-making process, having a risk management framework provides common ground to make more consistent decisions that are in line with the risk tolerance of the organization, right? So it's all about being very transparent with which risks you're managing, and the decision-making process on how you go about making decisions that are ultimately good long-term for the business.
Excellent. So it's creating that alignment within the organization on how do we evaluate risks, what are these risks, and making sure it's in line with the organizational objectives and those sorts of things, correct?
Absolutely, yes. Right. Generally leaders I think are faced with two questions, operational leaders. The first one is, what are my significant risks that I should be actively managing? And then the second one is, how is my aggregated risk profile changing, right? And of course, how is it acceptable, right? In both cases, for both questions, you need to ask yourself what's acceptable, which is your risk tolerability, which should really be stated as an organization and have a common understanding of what's acceptable and what's not.
Yes, absolutely. Creating that clear definition is vitally important, not just in risk management, but everything we do. Prioritization, asset criticality, all those things, you need that clear definition. Now, what are the key components to a good risk management framework?
So I think there's probably about seven of them, and you'll see different, different expressions of what a risk management framework. But for me, the first one is that you need to have a method of identifying all your significant risks, or at least those risks that are big enough that they're worth actively managing. And for me, it's important to have a systematic method of identifying all those risks. Very often, organizations manage risks by exception, which means that they only manage the risks that they know about, where, perhaps the equipment's kind of tapping them on the shoulder and say, hey, I've got a problem. A more rigorous framework or practice within the framework would be to make sure that you review all of your, at least your highly critical assets, and ask the question, do I have risks here? Because if you don't ask all the questions, you might not uncover and reveal all the risks that you need to care about. The second item is, of course, recording those risk items in a risk registry that's visible within the organization, where you can document your decisions, your actions, and manage the outcomes of those. That's pretty important. And it's also important to manage different types of operational risks. For example, if your organization in process industries, for example, you've got operations who very often are focused on those near-term imminent operational failures that might affect production. You've got maintenance that cares about kind of the risks that affect their cost and the reliability of the equipment. And then you've got maybe the plant engineering view, which very often is longer term, future looking, in terms of assets that are going to require investment, and they want to avoid major accidents. So those are three different perspectives that are all individually valid. And so your risk register should probably have all of those on there. And they might be managed a little bit differently, but they should all be within there. The next item is the competencies required to both evaluate risk and also make decisions on that. And very often I find that is those competencies are very, very often overlooked. How you characterize the risks is, very often organizations will have a risk matrix, and which is kind of a qualitative or semi-quantitative method of expressing risk. And it's good to be able to prioritize risk to see which ones are higher than others. There's another expression of risk that is fully quantitative, which is a bit more analytical. I shouldn't say a bit more, a lot more analytical, can be used as well. The other aspect of evaluating risk is around confidence. So, risk is managing uncertainty, right? But very often we try to put a number on our uncertainty. We think the probability is going to be this, right? And we think the consequence is going to be that. Well, there's also an aspect that often goes overlooked is our confidence in that assessment. If you don't have a lot of information about the asset health, for example, you might have low confidence in that, which means that the answer could be within a wide range. So the proper expression of risk is actually, here's the number or the range with an expression of confidence, right? So for example, it might be, the probability might be, 3 to 5 years with a confidence interval of 90%. Which helps you do evaluations. It also, helps our leaders signals to them how much we know about the actual underlying problem that is within the risk. So I think that's important ultimately in the decision-making processes. We mentioned it kind of early on, but it's very important to the next element here is tolerability. An organization or an individual leader who's making risk-based decisions needs to know what their tolerability is. And that should drive the decisions that are made, you know, whether it's, you know, very often there's three kind of zones on a risk matrix. There's the generally acceptable risk. There's the tolerable with a LARP, which is as low as reasonably practicable. And last is intolerable risk, which is the zone that you kind of want to stay out of and is generally red, right? And, you know, you can have different tolerability for different consequence types. You can have a tolerability for safety consequences. And generally that shouldn't really change over time. And it should also be fairly consistent across the company. But if there's other consequences that are financial, you might have different tolerabilities in different business units and different sites or different countries. And you can allow for that. But it is important. You can really only make a good risk decision if you understand your risk tolerability. Next, of course, we have the mitigative actions that are both, you know, practical and worth implementing. It's important that, and as I think you alluded to, fit within your strategy as well. So you need to keep track of those mitigative actions and the opportunity actions as well. Also on the accountability side, the next item is, you know, the decisions that we make for risk-based decisions need to be done by leader with the appropriate level of authority and competency, right? So these leaders need to be trained and have certain competencies to make decisions, and those decisions need to be aligned with their authority within the organization on behalf of the organization. And, you know, finally, we have to execute the approved actions. You actually need to mitigate those risks, and you need to track that. Ideally, you know, some risks kind of reveal themselves and are very real time, and you need to take action very quickly. Whereas other risks, you know, you have the ability to see them in advance, and you've got some time to plan them and actually make them part of your business plans and execute them within your budgets. That's the preferred way to manage them, obviously. But not all risks can be have that kind of time horizon. Sometimes you need to act quickly. So those are kind of the key elements of a functional risk management framework.
So there's a lot involved with this, but you touched on one key point that I want to make sure we reiterate. Is you can do all these great things, but if you don't implement those actions, mm-hmm. it's all for naught. Just like RCM, just like FMEAs, if you don't implement those actions, you wasted a tremendous amount of time developing the process and system behind it.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I've seen two pitfalls that organizations can fall into. One is you identify the risk, but you don't necessarily make a decision about it, or your default decision is do nothing different, right? That's the first kind of pitfall. And then the second one is what you just mentioned, and is you make a decision on how you want to go forward, but you don't ultimately action all of those activities. You know, maybe some are done, maybe they aren't all done, maybe none of them are done, but you know, certainly organizations have probably seen instances where, you know, bad things happened and they hadn't taken the action that they had decided to do. And, you know, that also brings up another point I want to emphasize is, you know, risk management is, you know, it's all about uncertainty, right? So I just want to highlight that you can actually make a good decision and take the appropriate actions, and you know, unfortunate things can still happen because a lot of times you're not mitigating all of the risk. You're mitigating some of the risk, right, to what the organization feels is acceptable. That doesn't mean that, you know, an event might not still happen, right? So we always have to be careful how we react to things that happen. If you didn't take the action that you said you'd do, that's not good. If you did take the action that you said you did, and you did your proper due diligence, it is a fact of managing assets that some of these events can and still do happen.
Oh, absolutely. We can only make the most informed decision with the data we have. Sometimes we will miss certain things, as unfortunate as it is, and we just have to be able to have those mitigation plans in place to address some of those consequences and hopefully minimize the impact to the organization, the public, anyone else that could be potentially impacted by that risk becoming a reality.
Right.
Now, who should be involved in this development of a risk management framework? There's a lot of things we talked about. There's the tolerance, there's the quantitative approach to it. There's all these various pieces. Who actually develops this? Is it just a risk group by themselves? Is it just maintenance and reliability by themselves? Who actually does that?
No, generally, if you're going to design or redesign a framework, you should have participation by several different groups, you know, operations, maintenance, engineering. If you have a risk group, they should be involved. Environmental health and safety should be involved. I've actually been through an exercise where we replaced several different risk matrices and expressions of risk with one single one that fit for the entire organization. That it could use, and it was a group effort, and it was pretty amazing actually to get everybody to work together. We had a very specific goal, and it did take a little bit of time, but you know, everybody at the end of it was on the same page. You know, project risks, your project management group should be participating as well, and we were able to come together with a risk management framework, and specifically one risk matrix to kind of rule them all is kind of how we said it. But we were able to come up with that, and we got that, reviewed and approved by HR for the safety reasons. EH&S and HR for the people side of it, from our enterprise risk management group and our legal group. And, it was a very successful exercise. So, you have to pick your stakeholders very, very carefully, but participation in that actually, and helping develop it, is a good way to get that buy-in. The organizations will use it, if they're able to provide some input and influence it.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to have that cross-functional group that really can drive those decisions, have the information and the authority to make those or provide that guidance in the development of the framework.
Right.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out iridicio.com for a free copy of their ebook, A Smarter Way of Preventative Maintenance. This ebook will allow you to review your current maintenance program and eliminate the non-value-added work you are doing, which is most likely causing you more downtime than it is preventing. www.iridicio.com. Now, once we have this framework developed, how is it actually used in organizations? What do they actually, is it something they use on a regular basis? They're revisiting on a weekly or monthly basis? Is this a once a year activity? Or does this get embedded into the culture and every decision they make? Well, it may not be a formal risk review, but they're using the framework in their heads. So how is it actually used?
Yeah, I think when it comes to the risk management framework, it's, you know, a set of processes that you can use for different use cases. For example, you can use the risk matrix and apply it to, you know, project applications. You can use it for, you mentioned asset criticality. We've actually taken that that risk matrix that was approved by the enterprise, and we've applied it the consequence side only, not the probability side, but the consequence side only, and use that to identify asset criticality. So I consider that a use case of the risk matrix. You know, some of it is risks that you identify and manage kind of on the fly in real time. There's other risks that, for example, some of our life cycle costing and analysis, and some of our asset investment planning, so our capital project development, we do that more on an annual. It's kind of real time, but then we review it on an annual basis, and the results of that get built into our business plans. So, you know, and I would say the very large risks in the of operational risks, the ones that are material to the enterprise, they get bumped up into the enterprise risk management system, which only deals with kind of the material risks from operations, from finance, and other parts of the organization. So I think the answer is, you know, your framework can have a multiple and variety of different uses and use cases, and you need to make sure that all of those use cases are aligned to your and work with your within your risk management framework.
Very good. So it's something that, you know, depending upon the different levels within the organization, you're going to use it a little bit differently. You mentioned the enterprise risk management system, which is a little bit different than how someone on the shop floor might be applying it.
Right, exactly. Another use case of it, for example, on the shop floor is maintenance order prioritization. So we utilize a two-factor prioritization. One is asset criticality, and then the other factor is more of an urgency factor. How quickly do we need to respond to this? And with those two factors, we're able to prioritize our maintenance, which helps set the planning and the schedule.
Yeah, absolutely. The ranking index of maintenance expenditures, the work priority times asset criticality gives us the RPN. We prioritize the highest RPN.
Right, exactly.
Excellent. Now, what else must be considered in risk management? Is it just as simple when we're evaluating risks as severity times probability of occurrence, or is there different things we need to consider and really dive into?
Well, I mean, it's in its basic form, the definition of risk is consequence times probability, but certainly in a risk management framework, it's a whole bunch more than that. You know, I said earlier, you know, identifying risk is not even half the battle. The real battle is making good decisions based on that perceived risk. And you know, one of the things I've learned is that organizations and individuals actually, not organizations, you know, the human brain isn't wired naturally to understand uncertainty. The human brain always looks for certainty and is very deterministic in its thinking. But risk management is very probabilistic in its thinking. And so people have a hard time assessing uncertainty and assessing risk. And you know, the second part of that is kind of a double whammy, because not only are people not good at understanding, assessing risk, but they're overconfident in their ability to do so. You know, I've seen examples where, you know, I had a very competent, well-respected engineer who I was working on a problem with, and he was describing the risk. We were using a 5x5 matrix to express a risk, and you know, I asked him what the consequence was of this electrical switchgear failing, and he said, "Oh, well, this is going to happen," and he had some pretty good confidence in that, and it seemed reasonable. That he knew what the consequence was. But then I asked him, what's the probability? What's the likelihood of that event happening? And he said, 100%. I said, well, wait a minute. We're talking about, you know, what's the probability that it's going to fail in the next 1 year? I said, yeah, I think it's 100%. And so he went on. I asked some probing questions. And, you know, I asked him, well, how long has it been like this? Oh, it's been in this bad condition for 5 years. And every year I've tried to get the organization to replace it. And so I just kind of paused, and I waited for kind of the light bulb to go on, because what in my mind, what he had just expressed to me, that, you know, in 5 years, the condition hadn't gotten worse. It hadn't failed. So my simple math suggested that the probability of failure in the next year was no more than 20%. But he was still sure that it was going to be 100% likelihood of failure. And so that for me was one of the first real instances where I realized that, you know what, maybe not all of us are good at assessing risk. And, you know, more recently I've seen examples where the risk assessment is changed based on the context. So for example, if an engineer is expressing risk and they want a project to go forward, they might overstate what that risk is, right? So that it gets kind of higher in the prioritization order. And I've also seen if you're in a business planning process and you can't do all the work that you wanted to do, you know, and you're asking yourself, well, what work can we either defer or eliminate on a risk basis? I've actually seen individuals change their risk assessment in terms of their probability. Oh yeah, we don't think that's going to happen. And so they actually change it. Well, wait a minute, the risk hasn't changed. Your assessment changed just because of the context that it's being used. And you know, those are some of the the behaviors that I've seen that kind of lead me to wonder, you know, how good are we at assessing risk? Which is, as I said, only the first part of managing risk. So I do think there's a lot more to it than just, you know, severity and probability. There's a competency there that needs to be worked on. I've also learned more recently that you can actually train people and calibrate people to become better at assessing uncertainty. And the real trick is to make sure that that assessment is grounded in some way, shape, or form, right? With simple logic, right?
Yes, absolutely. There is that competency piece behind there. There's that understanding of risk. There's that, how do you evaluate it properly? And it is not, like you said, 100% it's going to fail this year. No, we have to be realistic. You have to have a good facilitator to ask those types of probing questions to get to the right answer.
Yes.
It's just like an FMEA or RCM again. If you don't have a good facilitator, it is going to be very painful, very slow, and you're probably not going to get the best results out of it.
Yeah, and so it does.
It's a huge piece there.
You're right. And it does help. You know, the individual should have their own competencies developed. And very often organizations just feel like they've got the people who can do it, and they don't seek those specific competencies. But the other thing, as you mentioned, it does help in these to have a good facilitator to ask the right questions, and somebody who maybe doesn't understand the assets all that well, but they understand the risk management process and can ask those questions and challenge what they hear, and they can be an objective observer. The result, of course, for any good facilitator, they don't own the result. The people who are making the assessments and owning the results, they need to own it, but good facilitators can certainly help.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned previously, and you touched on it previously, but I just want to make sure it's clear for everyone. If you have a corporation with multiple sites, multiple installations, spread across, whether it's a country, the globe, whatever the case may be, should they all follow that same framework, or should they each have their own independent one?
I think definitely the enterprise should strive to have the same framework as wide as you can make it, right? Because within that framework, you can still set, for example, different tolerabilities. You can still have different use cases that are aligned but fit for the specific needs of that site or that business unit or that organization. So I think having the broad framework apply across the company is very, very important. That said, you know, the lower you go down in the organization, I think if you build your framework well, you can allow for differences. For example, I keep going back to tolerability. When it comes to safety and probably environmental consequences, and perhaps other consequences too, like company reputation, chances are you want the same tolerability at all of your sites, right? But for financial consequences, you may allow your tolerability to vary from site to site. You know, depending on the market, depending on the you know, the asset and its kind of native financial situation, you may allow for different levels of tolerance, and you might have different practices, specific practices at each site. But I think you should strive to have as much consistency and standardization as possible and make adjustments where is needed, but still maintain that alignment so that whatever you're doing, you can still say that, you know, at the highest level, at the enterprise level, you're still consistent with that risk management framework.
Excellent. It's striving for, like you said, that standardization, consistency across the network. You may have individual differences at sites on tolerability because of regulatory requirements, stuff of that nature.
Mm-hmm. But
for the most part, we want that standardized approach. Now, building on that standardized approach, there is an ISO standard on risk management, 31,000. Have you seen that widely adopted, and why or why not do you think that is?
I think organizations, you know, I mentioned at the front end of this, I think all organizations do risk management, and many have practices that are aligned with the specific elements of ISO 31000. So you could certainly look at that and say, yeah, I mean, they are aligned with that. But, you know, not a lot of organizations that I've seen have actually sought accreditation and certification to that standard. And I've also seen a lot of variability in risk management practices from company to company and even within companies. Generally, I think most organizations could probably improve their risk management practices and get more value out of it. So while I do see aspects of the ISO 31000 in action, I also see that a lot of organizations could and should probably improve how they manage risk.
So the individual elements you've seen adopted, but people actually getting certified against that standard you haven't seen widely adopted. But everyone should be striving to the best practices identified within that standard.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it is an international standard and a best practice for risk management. So, I think organizations owe it to their stakeholders to manage their assets with that in mind.
Very good.
You know, there's another aspect about, you know, if you have, you know, I always think in terms of good, better, and best practice. If you have poor risk management practices, you know, you can leak significant value from the organization over time. And it's not always the large events that and catastrophic events that we hear about. Those things, you know, can and do happen, but it's also about a lot of, you know, smaller events, the death by a thousand cuts type of thing. So, you know, having a really good risk management practice can add significant value to the organization. As we all know, you know, the whole premise around asset management is to deliver value from your assets. So it can be a significant positive or negative driver to your business.
Absolutely. It can make or break programs. It can make that bottom line much larger, or it could be make the difference between being it in the red versus the black if you have a good program in place. Now, with that, do you have any tips or words of wisdom you want to share with our listeners who are working with developing a risk management framework?
Yeah. So if you're developing a risk management framework, if you have the opportunity to craft that and influence it, my suggestion is to collaborate, get your internal stakeholders and, you know, maybe even external stakeholders as well, because sometimes we have to manage our assets, you know, with our customers' risk tolerance in mind as well. So, you know, those groups that I had mentioned earlier, operations, maintenance, engineering, you know, risk, EH&S, you know, all those groups should be contributing, project management, all those groups should be contributing to developing the framework. But make the process and what you build very, very transparent. Standardize it as much as you can. Develop people's competencies, which is more than just training, for both the practitioners and the leaders, and record the risk items and the decisions and actions and the results that come from that.
Excellent. Great, great advice for those looking to implement and develop that risk management framework. Now, what is the one thing you see done incorrectly with risk analysis that you really would like to change if you could?
So for that one, I think the assessment of the risk, and I mentioned this already, James, so maybe this is a place where we can switch it up. So so this is where the human brain's not wired to understand uncertainty. You know, most of us think very deterministically and not probabilistically. So we're not good at characterizing uncertainty. We're much better at understanding, you know, specific consequences. rather than the probabilities. What's worse is people think they're better at understanding and assessing uncertainty than they actually are, and this can be dangerous. The good news is that people can be calibrated to better state uncertainty, but it's a competency that, you know, often goes ignored by practitioners and leaders alike. So, you know, my advice is get calibrated. For those people that, you know, you ask within the organization to assess risk, they should be calibrated to understand and to be able to properly evaluate uncertainty and whether it's the probability of an event happening or the consequences. Generally, people are better at understanding the consequences than the likelihood or probability. But that calibration is an important competency that should be developed within the organization for individuals who are participating.
Excellent. And lastly, one last question for you before we get ready to close out. What is the one action you want our listeners to take away from the conversation we've had on risk management today?
I would say, because I just mentioned the practitioner side. So from the leader's side, you know, one of the things I've learned is the most important decision you make is how you make your decision. So carefully think how you as a leader or other leaders in your organization at different levels, how do they and should they make risk-based decisions? And it should be a fairly consistent process. You know, I've seen leaders make very big decisions, you know, with their gut instincts, and there's a time and place for making decisions with your gut instincts, but that time and place is for smaller risks that don't have huge consequences, right? But for those larger risks that have large consequences, you know, either high probability or high consequence, you have to make sure that the organization and the decision ultimately is based on the right level of rigor and analysis. So you don't want to do too much analysis because that isn't adding value. You want to do the correct amount that's suitable for the size of the risk. So from the leadership perspective, making risk-based decisions, the competency there is to understand your decision-making process.
Yep. Understand that decision-making process, provide input to refine it, to drive more consistent decision-making, those sorts of things. Excellent. Very good action for our listeners to take away. Now, where can people find out more about you, about CEO? Are you going to be speaking at any events coming up in the near future? That sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm the launch of CEO Asset Management. So you can find me on CEO, that's SCIOAM.com. And I have a presence on LinkedIn, Twitter. I have our body of knowledge is going to be, and our community is going to be on patreon.com, which is an interesting platform for creators. So I recommend you check that out. So that's patreon.com/SCIOAM. And I also began writing some articles on medium.com. So that's medium.com/@PDouster. And that's about it. That's where you can find me. I'm not speaking at any events in the next little while, but I will be attending a few conferences in the new year, I hope. Certainly, I'll be at PMAC's Main Train Conference next September, which is going to be in Ottawa.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll have the opportunity to sit down with you again in person. We met in person the first time at the Saskatoon PMAC.
Yes, we did.
So hopefully we'll have an opportunity to do it again there.
I'm sure we'll make some time.
Absolutely. All right. Excellent. Well, Paul, I'd like to thank you for sharing your knowledge on risk management with our listeners. It's definitely a topic that comes up often. I think it's a little misunderstood, but you provided some great clarity to our listeners today on that. So thank you very much for taking the time today.
Appreciate the opportunity, James.
All right. Well, with that, thank you and have a great night.
You as well. Bye-bye.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the Reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing this small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.